This guy hates women. I think it's, if I'm being generous to Fleming, I think he's trying to use it as an example of his inhumanity and how he's pushed and pulled between being a human and being a weapon and being a spy and being totally heartless. And to him, women represent humanity. They represent a softer side.
A vulnerability.
Yeah. And so he's fighting with the idea of being vulnerable and the idea of having any sort of like mercy or like softness to his soul and his heart. And women represent that to him.
Yeah.
And so he hates them.
Yeah. And I do think you're being generous with that statement you just made.
Welcome, friends, to episode 304 of the Ink to Film podcast, where we read the book and then see the movie. I'm writer Luke Elliott.
And I'm filmmaker James Bailey.
And this week we discuss Ian Fleming's 1953 novel, Casino Royale. So, James, I think it would be appropriate for us to start this episode off, and I'm just going to let you take this because I'm sure you've got it. Go ahead and explain for our listeners how the game of Baccarat is played.
So, I interpreted it as a form of blackjack, right?
Kind of. It's a casino game. It involves cards. It's kind of pokerish, kind of like blackjack.
Trying to get like nines. It seems nines are basically unbeatable. And then you have to try to like, you get a card and then you can basically hit to get another card if you have a low enough number, but it's risky.
There's a narrow way of like betting in a way that affects the outcome, but mostly it seems luck-based. Exciting. The novel spends 25 pages explaining this game, and I still don't think I understand it.
1950s gambling culture and how cool that is. A lot of this book is, I think, how cool some of this stuff is.
Totally. So if you are here to hear about how great James Bond is as a character and how there's nothing problematic about him and not to hear us talk about how he's incredibly sexist in this book, this isn't going to be an episode you're going to like, because we're going to do that. I do think there's some interesting stuff going on with the character, and we can talk about why he is portrayed this way. I'm just going to go ahead and let those people know they can leave now if you don't want to hear people talk about how this is some really sexist shit in this book.
Yeah, yeah. I guess cool should have been in quotes when I said that, I guess, a minute ago. Now, it's like the ultimate 1950s, like post-World War II male wish fulfillment kind of story. It's like that's exactly what it was set out to be, I think.
I think that's the goal of it to an extent, though, because Bond is also very different than he is in the movies. And I kept tripping over the fact that like my deep connections to Bond as a character all go back to childhood and all the different versions I've seen of him on screen. I've never read an Ian Fleming novel before. I've never read a Bond novel before. So this version of Bond is very different, and it kept bumping up with like what I had in my mind that's so deeply ingrained. And that character absolutely is male wish fulfillment in every way. This character kind of is, but is also this kind of brutish, deeply flawed and wounded man who has a very narrow view of the world and is like kind of inhuman in a way. And I think a lot of the arc of the book is about him trying to find some humanity, but then it doesn't turn out. We're not worried about spoilers. This is a very old book, but and that element of it is not something that I like usually associate with Bond. And so I had to keep like reminding myself, this is not the Bond from the film. This is a different version of this character.
Sherlock Holmes is to detective work as James Bond is to espionage work. He's got a superpower for spy work. And it's like unnatural. And there's all these ways that he does it, tools that he's learned over time. And it's kind of taught him to be closed off from the world. And that's very much like his character is like completely closed off to the point that he thinks very lowly of certain people and like has this certain idea of how the world runs. And I think that like Ian Fleming is doing something interesting with how the arc of this story and maybe James Bond being caught off guard in a few scenarios.
A lot of thoughts there, but I did just want to go ahead and get this out there too. This is a quarterly project for us, which means it was voted on by our patrons. This isn't one that I probably would have chosen. Maybe we would have got to it eventually. It's always like, of course, it's a, you know, massive name and adaptations. But going back to like my kind of experience with Bond is that I've always, like he's he, to me he's like a cartoon character, and that's kind of evidenced by the way he's portrayed in the films. But then also, like, I grew up playing GoldenEye and different Bond video games over the years, so like he's a video game character to me in a sense. He's just a suit with a gun, and he talks suave, and you know, he is kind of that ideal, I guess, in that he's a womanizer, and everybody wants to be him, and all the women want him, and he's just like so charismatic. But like, I don't know, I never saw myself in that character. This was so unlike me, and unlike the kind of person I wanted to be. I know some men grow up idealizing Bond and like wanting to dress in tuxedos and be that way. And
I mean, I think there's a significant portion of people, especially from I think an era before us, like a generation before, because you think of like the shaken, not stirred, the wearing the tuxedos, the always suave, gets the girl, action hero. And like espionage in general is like a sexy genre. Again, like 1950s, you think about where the world's at with the Cold War brewing and like the spies that are like very prevalent.
That's the spy era, right? So he's releasing a spy novel right in the midst of, you know, the Cold War. So
I think you can definitely see like people of that generation saying like, oh, I'd love to be a spy, travel the world, see all these locales, be like this ultimate badass. I do think like, I mean, there's no question when I was reading it that I was like, this is kind of a tough read for a modern audience. I bounced off of it many times and I was like, thank God this book is relatively short, because I was not loving it, to be perfectly honest. There are fun spy elements, and it's cool to see this as like basically the grandfather of a lot of other spy, I think, stories going forward. I don't know that this is the first, but
existing genre when he was writing it. I don't know how long it had been cranking, you know, and how long it had been going and being popular, but he was writing a spy novel when he wrote it, which was already a thing.
Yeah, I think it's the most iconic spy character though, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing, like he then changed the genre and made it into what it, you know, it, I guess, is now. I don't know if it's still a big genre, I guess, but what it became was sort of defined by these novels. But what is your experience with Bond in general? Like, were you a Bond fan growing up? I don't know. We've talked about Bond before, James.
I mean, very similar story to you. I mean, I grew up with the Pierce Brosnan Bond, and then of course played GoldenEye. You know, I've seen all of. I think I've seen nearly every Bond film just as like a film exercise. Like I remember being like, this is a massive series. Mm-hmm. A lot of people's dads talk about like, oh, you got to watch the, you know, Connery ones. So like I went back and watched them. You know, some of them have some highs and some of them are dated in a lot of ways. I think each Bond is kind of iconic in its own. And I do like a mantle that gets passed from person to person as like an iconic character. There is something really fun about having that in storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. I've always felt like I'm not the target demo for this. Like, I am. Like, literally, white dude. Straight white dude, I am the target demo. But, like, I always felt on the outside of the, like, suave, fashionable, charismatic dudes. I don't know. I'm always more interested in the oddballs and the outsiders. And that's not what Bond is, right? in most sense. But on the other hand, like it's a fun franchise. It's so crazy. It's so over the top at times. And the video games are fun. I agree. So I always kind of had that. And by the way, were you an oddball player? Did you choose?
Oh
oddball?
Yeah, I'm throwing that hat at you every time.
No oddball.
Odd job, right?
Odd job. Thank you. Yeah. Odd job.
I also like the era of like the Daniel Craig Bond kind of started to play with the form a little bit and started to play with the idea of a spy story. And I think like Skyfall, and there's a few in there that do some fun things. I will say like the last few unfortunately weren't like the most riveting, and maybe it's just the time that we're in. It is like it's just not as exciting to see these kinds of stories anymore. But
I think I've missed a few now, like two or three.
But I think Daniel Craig kind of it took the Pierce Brosnan era that was like just like you said, a cartoon character, like way over the top. Granted, I did love the gadgets growing up. That Q coming in and all of that stuff I thought was the coolest. M as a character we're going to talk about in this story as well, but the more I analyze it as an adult, and like I haven't engaged with this material in a really long time, or at least, you know, not like the older versions of James Bond, thinking of like M and thinking of like that, I guess I'll call it naive period when you just assume that there's this organization that is headed by someone like M that knows best and can basically shoot these like people who are just like the best in the world at what they do at problems. And I think nowadays I'm looking at it and saying like, okay, like that's kind of fucking scary more than anything. And I think right. maybe at one time there was an audience who was responding to that and thinking like, oh, that's comforting to think that this might be out there.
Yeah, I think so. I think there was a lot of people who saw this as like, fuck yeah, you know, because this
military,
is military
industrial kind of thing.
Yeah. And they're like, yeah, the British, like we have our secret forces that are working around the world, and they're super cool, and they have our best interests in mind. Yeah,
I guess it's kind of interesting to talk about James Bond, and this is maybe more of a film version of it, but to talk about like the idea that like Americans had to have their version, and you get like the Ethan Hunt with the Mission Impossible films, and like how crazy those have gone. Like they've kind of gone the other direction and been like, let's go way over the top and do this crazy stunt work. And I do think that
but they didn't start out that way. Like, I mean, they kind of got there, but you know, obviously there was like older versions.
Those there have been quite a few good Mission Impossible movies, especially in like the back half of you know, interesting to note that like that genre, clearly people were interested in it, and the American version versus like the Bond version, and seeing like the Bond get more serious and over time, and maybe like the Ethan Hunt getting more playful with that sort of story, action adventure spy espionage thriller kind of thing.
It's a massive genre, and again, like as a adolescent boy, it was fun, you know. It's just I feel like I kind of left it behind somewhere in that era, and it's not something I think about a lot. I kept up with the Daniel Craig Bond movies for a while because it felt like they were doing something kind of different with them, and it was a reimagining of the character, which every time you get a new Bond, they do that, right? Like every actor brings a new thing to it, but then also the directors have their own spin and take, and so it'll be interesting to revisit that film because I don't think I've seen it in quite a long time, and I'm curious to see how it holds up. I remember Daniel Craig as being like a very understated performance compared to some of the other ones, so yeah, that's all movie talk.
Yeah,
we're here to talk about the book today. We're here to talk about a version of Bond that smokes 70 cigarettes a day.
Yes.
70. Yep. Drinks heavily, loves champagne, but also like is thinking about coming up with their own version of a martini, which is pretty different than the version in the movie. Yeah, he wants to call it a Vesper. And is just an incredible sexist. Let's talk about that.
Sure.
Because I think we got to address it up front. This guy hates women. I think it's, if I'm being generous to Fleming, I think he's trying to use it as an example of his inhumanity and how he's pushed and pulled between being a human and being a weapon and being a spy and being totally heartless. And to him, women represent humanity. They represent a softer side.
A vulnerability.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he's fighting with the idea of being vulnerable and the idea of having any sort of like mercy or like softness to his soul and his heart. And women represent that to him.
Yeah.
And so I think he hates them.
Yeah. And I do think you're being generous with that statement you just made. Like, of course, you're just
trying to give it like the full benefit of the doubt of analysis. But like when you read it, it's just like,
especially
he wants to have sex with them. Don't get me wrong.
Exactly.
But that is all he wants. And otherwise, he wants them gone. He doesn't want them like fucking up his man's business. He wants them in the kitchen where they belong. Like shit like that is legitimately said in this book. It's not a joke. Like it's there.
Not to mention, like, every single woman in the story is a sex object. Like, like from the narrator, from Bond's POV, from all of it.
Yes.
So it's like you can't give Fleming that much credit because clearly he was objectifying women, like, all over the story.
And knowing a little bit about him as a person, it sounds like it kind of tracks with him.
Well, I think it's interesting to also track, as we talk about more of the spoiler at the end of this story, Bond's sort of distrust and like not wanting to be involved in any way, not even like work alongside a woman, and kind of where that leads him and how that maybe was unfortunately then taken and put into like every spy story going forward, where like this one plays like a particular like there's a twist, and I think that like the maybe the people like were like, well, forget the twist, let's just continue to treat women like this as well and specifically in Fleming Bond novels.
Yeah, I haven't read any other ones, but I, from what I understand, that this sets up a pattern. There's always a new woman in every book.
For what we are familiar with, the films do carry that through, and you know, it'll be interesting to track that maybe in the film and to see how we feel like they you know, adapted as time went on, to see if like there was, you know, if it's still just as problematic in the film, because I don't really remember Casino Royale.
How did it affect your ability to enjoy the book?
I couldn't, like, all the women were just completely hollow characters. Like, they're the way that Daniel Craig just, like, his presence just, like,
Daniel Craig.
causes yes, Daniel Craig, the way that Bond just affects people in the room, men and women, but
Yeah.
specifically the women are just immediately, like, throwing themselves at him. It really
He's really
led me
hot, man. He's got a chiseled bod.
sure
We
he
talk a lot
in
about how
19 yeah
chiseled he is.
1950s chiseled bod,
Yeah.
sure. And he's smoking cigarettes and drinking heavily, so I'm sure it looks fantastic, but you
Yeah.
know, is what it is. So anyway, his treatment towards women and the like, the specifically the way that, like, a woman walks in the room, we're gonna hear about her skirt, we're gonna hear about her hair, we're gonna hear about
The
her,
boobs,
like,
don't forget the
everything, the
boobs.
boobs, the curves.
Exactly. I mean, it always breaks down to that. And then, yeah, like, just all of his attitudes about it were pretty awful. So I could tell that, like, I don't know, a lot of older books do this. They try and present this as like a personality quirk of this character you're reading, is that this guy really doesn't like women. And, like, we can all kind of laugh about it, ha ha ha, but, like, kind of get it, right? That was kind of the attitude that I was getting from the book. And so that's just, like, turning me up, because I'm just like, oh man, I don't agree with this worldview. I don't like this character. Whenever I read a character like this, instead of it being some, like, quirk of his personality that I can, like, either look past or not look past, it always starts to make that character feel small to me. And so I'm reading about Bond, and this guy just seems just like such a small person. And that is the exact opposite, I would think, thing that, like, Fleming wants us to view him as, right? Like, he wants us to be impressed with this guy. And I'm just like, this guy is so, like, pathetic. Like, I don't like him. I don't like this version of Bond. And I'm not saying that the other, versions of Bond in the films are necessarily not sexist, because, you'd have to go movie by movie. But, I mean, I think there's a long history of that. But this feels like the worst example of it I had seen. It's like everything that you were worried might be going on in Bond's head when you're watching him in the movie. It's like, oh no, it's all worse than you imagined in this book. And yeah, it just made me think of him as just kind of a sad man that I don't like.
So just an example of this too, the thing that was it was bad throughout, but near the end of the novel, they're talking about, like, these two characters are having sex. Vesper and Bond are having sex, and they're falling in love, it seems, and there's, like,
Yeah.
drawn out, like the conclusion of the story is basically really happened. And then there's, like, a lot of sex afterwards, because I guess that's important for us to know that he fucks. But he
Still works, James.
yeah.
His
So
dick
we get
still
to the
works.
point where they're talking about, like, their lovemaking and all this other stuff. And specifically, he talks about there's something that he can't figure out about Vesper. And it's, like, you know, obviously this is, like, leading to the twist. But he says that, like, when having sex with her is like, it's like weirdly forceful, or it feels like raping her. And when he said that, I was like, all right, all of the other stuff became worse. This is the like pinnacle moment of, like, that's everything, is that he's saying, I like having sex with her because it's like raping her.
So,
And I was
dude,
like,
it's even worse than you're kind of putting it out. Because I wrote down a little bit about that line. So he's talking about how she has, like, a secret room in her soul or something where she's, like, not revealing something. And so he says that having sex with her carries the sweet tang of rape,
There you go.
because of that secret. And that's pretty fucking gross to read. So that's the kind of stuff that, yeah, you get in this book. So I don't necessarily recommend it for people. You can hear us talk about it. If you are curious about the origins of Bond, sure, check it out for that reason. But I don't know. I didn't find a lot to like in this book. Also, Bond, good at gambling, decent at reading people, although a lot of his, like, reads carried a lot of racism and judgment based off of, like, taking huge leaps based off of basically nothing.
Everyone at the table that he's gambling with is just like their ethnicity, basically, and, like,
Exactly.
stereotypes
Yeah.
based on that.
And in the book, he's, like, right, of course. So it's like, But yeah, it was like the huge leaps he was making, I was not there for. But then, time and again, he would get himself into these, like, troubled moments where he's going to possibly get killed, and, like, he would either just, like, flail about to get out of it, or he would just get really fucking lucky. And, like, the whole book was about, like, just how lucky this guy is. If anything, that was his superpowers. He was just incredibly lucky.
And he was just paranoid too. Like
Yeah.
the certain paranoia that they build up very early on in one of the first chapters is, like, he's doing the whole hair on the door and the different drawers and everything trick, and he's got, like, things
That
placed
reminded me of Misery,
specifically.
by the way.
Exactly, yeah. So he's doing all of that to know if somebody's rifling through his shit. And then guess what? he doesn't realize people are fucking listening in on him and stuff. So again, like he, there is like a mole that's kind of like leaking all the ways that he's vulnerable, but, which we'll just, I guess I'll just say here is Vesper. We've come to find out throughout the story. Like every time he's in a jam is basically like when she was like, she was told not to stand behind him at one point at the gambling table so somebody could run up and put a gun up against his back. Sort of situations like that. She staged a kidnapping that led to him actually being taken and tortured and everything. And then guess what? He doesn't get himself out of that torture session either.
Well, we're getting really deep into plot, so maybe we should hold off on that because we're gonna do that in a minute. I do want to talk about Ian Fleming, at least for a little bit, the person. So he is a British writer, best known for his post-war James Bond series of spy novels. Born in 1908, would die in 1964, age of 56, so rather young. He was a binge drinker and smoker throughout his life, and that definitely heavily contributed to heart failure and health problems, and he died fairly young. He came from a wealthy family connected to a bank. His father would die on the Western Front in 1917, so in World War I. He would go on to join the military through becoming an assistant to an admiral in the British Intelligence Division at the start of the Second World War. So he kind of came in as like an officer and kind of behind the scenes. And that, I don't know a ton about his military history. I read through some of it, but there's a lot of terms I don't know. It seemed to me, as a total layman, that he was involved in a lot of the like planning and more operations size, as far as like he wasn't in the front. He wasn't the one who was out doing this stuff. He was kind of planning this stuff. He had like a group of these operatives that he oversaw, that he based a lot of James Bond off of, like these guys that he would work with, but he wasn't one of them. He was the one who was like sending them on their missions. And in fact, I read that like they didn't really like him because he would refer to him, and this is a racist term, but he would refer to them as his little red Indians, and they did not like that. So even among these people, he didn't necessarily have like the greatest of reputation. He would have an affair with a woman who was married to a baron, like an English baron. And that was like his first love, I guess, was with this woman. So she was cheating on her husband with him. I think maybe she got divorced from him, and then he later died. Anyway, she divorced him to get with Ian Fleming after the war. And he married her, and I think their first child was stillborn. So it was going through a rough patch. At the time, he had visited Jamaica and ended up really liking it there. And so he got a residence in Jamaica. So if you're wondering why Jamaica was like the place where Bond was hailing from in the book, like his cover story, you know, Fleming had this connection to Jamaica. He ended up naming his residence in Jamaica Goldeneye. It was off of like some real stuff he did that was called Goldeneye. And then that, of course, became like a big thing in his books. And while there, he started having an affair with another woman. So he was not only in love with someone who was cheating on her husband, but then when he finally did like get with her, he was then immediately cheating on her with someone else. So like this was the kind of relationships he was used to with women. You can see why it's pretty fucked up. I don't know. It's like, of course, like who knows what the ins and outs of all this stuff was. I'd have to like really dig into it to find out. Just doesn't sound healthy, I think, to put it mildly. But yeah, I mean, like he did have this long storied career in the military. He was involved in a lot of these different operations. While working for Britain's Naval Intelligence Division during the Second World War, Fleming was involved in the planning of Operation Goldeneye and in the planning and oversight of two intelligence units, the 30 Assault Unit and T-Force. He drew from his wartime service and his career as a journalist for much of the background detail and depth of his James Bond novels.
It sounds like anyone who thinks that he is James Bond and is writing about his own stories, that's not the case. He may be new people who were like James Bond. Sounds like he was doing some
that
of the
seems
planning.
More likely to me, but there's theories that he was actually a spy.
Interesting.
And that wouldn't be known, right? It seems like I don't know how, the validity of this. A lot of people have theorized. And of course, like he was involved in the war for a long time, certainly had PTSD of his own. How much actual like combat and stuff he saw, I don't know. But even just like ordering and like, you know, like organizing these missions is going to give you PTSD from the things that are happening.
Yeah.
So the idea of Bond as being this like deeply flawed human who is trying to like reconnect to humanity and has a bunch of PTSD. Because if you read between the lines, you could kind of read that with Bond as a character too. Whether or not Fleming was aware of it, I do think there's a lot of himself he's putting into this character.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly with the 70 cigarettes a day, that sounds like that might be true to Fleming, Fleming in real life too.
How he treats women, some of the affluent nature of some of the stuff that he's doing seems like Fleming maybe.
Son of a went rich with. Baker. So he definitely like operated in those like wealthier circles too.
Yeah.
So that's coming out here. So he would write his first Bond novel, Casino Royale, in 1952 at the age of 44. So still fairly young, he starts writing these books. The first one he wrote was when he was living in Jamaica. So he would like, it was like a home in Jamaica that he would go to for like, I think a couple months out of the year as like a holiday, probably in the wintertime, I would imagine. They would go to Jamaica, him and his wife. And so that became his like routine. Every time he went to Jamaica, he wrote a Bond novel after the kind of the relative success of this first one. And he had this whole thing where he wrote about how his like method of writing is that he would write for 3 hours in the morning and then he would write for one more hour in the evening and he would never stop writing and never look back at anything he wrote. That way he never like edited anything and he could get 2000 words out a day, which, you know, I kind of admire that. Like it's an interesting way of writing. It's a way where you can, of course, get a first draft done really quickly. And that's what he was doing. Whether or not it's going to be high quality, I guess he didn't care. He would edit that at another time or hand it, actually more likely, I think he handed it to other people to edit, including women who he based, like there's a woman that he based M off of, you know, his wife. He had like an ex-girlfriend who told him not to publish the book when she read it, which I was also interested. I'm like, why is he showing it to his ex-girlfriend? I don't know. But she told him like, if you're going to publish it under a pseudonym.
Yeah.
I think cause she was like, you're going to get a bad reputation for this book. So he called, the manuscript of, Casino Royale, a dreadful oafish opus. So he didn't have a lot of like hopes for it. And I don't think he thought it was very good, but one of his friends kind of recommended that he pursue getting it published and he had connections. So he had connections. I think it was through his brother. Ended up like putting it in the hands of a publisher and was like, you should read this and check it out. And they were like, this is okay. I don't know. But then it was like, he was like convinced. And you know, he gets these books out and it's kind of a surprise that they do well. And what we talked about, I think is the case here is that it comes out at a time where I think people just wanted to read about these spies because we're entering the Cold War and like Bond is out there. He's the like, exemplar of the spy fighting on the side of Britain against communism, and people wanted to read that. There's a huge appetite for this, so the books start doing well. He starts publishing like one like every year basically because he goes and he writes one and then he puts it out, and over time he starts to build a following for it and to build some popularity. But it wasn't until I think you told me before we got on 1962 when the first adaptation is made. So he would only live to see a little bit, right? Because he would die in 64. So he wasn't necessarily alive for the phenomenon that Bond would become. And I do want to look into that a little more for our next episode of like, how much did he even experience this sort of huge phenomenon of James Bond that we know as today, you know?
I'm curious, like somebody who's a massive Bond fan in terms of for the novels, like where does this fall? Does he develop into something that's like more...
Yeah. I watched some videos with people talking about who actually do seem to like the series and how I do think there is a little bit of an arc to him. And like this book sets up a lot of his like ongoing quest to find humanity.
Sure.
But
even like the stuff with like M and Moneypenny and some of these other people being more involved and then like the gadgets, like when does that come about? Because there's no gadgets in this. Yeah.
Yeah. Very little.
The idea of this story, if I was to analyze like why people were interested in it, other than the Cold War sort of espionage element, you know, I think someone being inhumanly good at gambling is just like, that's kind of showing also the luck element to him. Sure. And like how that's, oh, if I could just go to the casino and be a big baller all the time and win every bet I make for
the
most part.
He has a line, I didn't write it down, but he has a line about luck where he's like, in luck, it's like either you have to approach it with absolute tenderness or you just have to get in there and ravage it just like a woman. And it's like, all right, dude. Like every fucking, it comes out of there like every so often, he just hits you with something. And you're like, whoa, dude.
Yeah.
All right, let's just get into the plot, man, and then we can get through this. M, the head of the British Secret Service, assigns James Bond, 007, to play against the bankrupt Le Chiff, the paymaster for a Smirsch-controlled trade union in a high-stakes baccarat game played at the Royal Elu Casino in northern France. I do not know how to pronounce that. Full caveat. As part of Bond's cover as a rich Jamaican playboy, M also assigns as his companion Vesper Lind, personal assistant to the head of Section S, Soviet Union. The CIA and the French Bureau also send agents as observers. The game soon turns into an intense confrontation between Le Chiff and Bond. Le Chiff wins the first round, cleaning Bond out of his funds, and as Bond contemplates the prospect of failure and having to report it to M, Felix Leiter gives him an envelope full of money and a note. Martial aid, 32 million francs, with the compliments of the USA. The game continues despite the attempts of one of Le Chiff's minders to kill Bond. Bond eventually wins, taking from Le Chiff 80 million francs belonging to Smirsch. So Smirsch is the, it's like the Russian spy agency themselves. And Le Chiff is like left them and is kind of a rogue agent now. And so they're also after him. And the whole like premise of this game seems to just be that like, we can't let the communists have this rich dude going around throwing around money, and we got to go like fuck with him and take that money away. And we're going to send Bond in to do it.
I kind of laughed to myself when I was reading this book, because I'm like, this is such a contrived, interesting story, because it's like, he wanted to create these like lavish scenarios where he could outsmart somebody or whatever it is, the sort of allure of being good at gambling. And he's like, how do I get there? All right, the villain is going to gamble to try to get back his losses.
Yeah.
And our guy's going to gamble even better.
Out-gamble him.
Yeah.
And, so, and like the whole plan is just for him to be better at gambling.
No, yeah, there's no trickery. It's just there's like, no trickery. Yeah, he's just good at gambling. So he's like, yeah, this guy.
Send in Bond. He's really good at gambling.
He smokes 70 cigarettes and drinks a lot. Yeah, he's good at gambling.
And he practices. Like, I mean, he earns like 400,000 francs or something like the night before, like practicing, just getting warmed up.
So that is just funny to me from the get-go. And then you layer in like, you know, all the misogyny stuff, the stuff with the like the way he treats women, the way he's looking at women.
Dude, when Vesper is assigned, he's so mad.
Yes.
And like, I don't think like, I don't know if it's easy for us to like convey this to you, listener, if you haven't read this book. But like, it's not subtle. It's the text. Is he hates them. He hates women. He doesn't want them around. He calls her a bitch from the jump. Like, he hates it. Every now and then he's like, well, she is hot. Maybe after this is over, I'll try and fuck her. You know, like that's like, that's how he thinks.
That's his thing, is that he's like, if we weren't on a mission, because I take my job so seriously, if we weren't.
He's so amazing. Like, how dare they assign her to this?
Yeah, I love that he like starts off calling her a bitch, comes to love her, and then like eventually it's just like bitch at the end.
Yeah.
Like,
and then like whenever anything bad happens, like she gets kidnapped, and he's like, oh fuck the bitch, I knew she was gonna get kidnapped. It's all so her fault. He's so mad about it. So and he bad, his man. First we haven't even got to the kidnapping yet, but like his first reaction when she gets kidnapped is just like, I guess I'll try and save her, but you know what, I'm gonna shoot at them, and if I hit her with a bullet, oh well. And yeah, if she ends up dying, fuck it, I'm gonna come back here and go back to sleep, and I'm not even gonna care. Like,
yeah,
that's his attitude. But yeah, let's talk about this opening thing. We got this long game, which, by the way, incredibly boring to read. I did not care at all. So much time is spent describing the game that I'm just like, I don't like listening to games being described in real life, but it's like a necessity to enjoy playing the game. But that's a game I'm actually going to play, so I'm at least invested. I'm not going to play Baccarat. I don't care. And it's just so hard to read all this, like, all this talk. But you kind of have to understand it, I guess, to like follow the ins and outs of the game. So that's why he's doing it, but he spends so long on it.
It's not enough for me personally, just because like the payoff is then you listen to them play cards, and then he like loses a bunch of money, gets bailed out by the US government giving him money, and then beats the guy.
His US friend Felix, who is like from Texas and represents the best
cowboy
of America. Yeah.
America.
They're really bro-y.
So they're playing cards and he loses all of his money. like I said, he gets bailed out by this American, but right around that time, somebody just comes up and puts a gun up against his back, and he's basically, they're basically like, stop fucking around. We know that you're, they thought that he was playing foul or whatever. So then they were like trying to intimidate him off the table, that kind of thing. Cause they realized
they didn't want him to rejoin the game. Cause he was going to rejoin with the new money. And they were like, no, you're not, you're too good a player, even though we beat you.
Yeah. And then the way he gets out of this, gun to his back, the way he gets out of this, like,
it's also like his lower back.
Yes.
And it's like kind of pressed between his ass cheeks is the way he describes it. He's talking a lot about this like hard barrel being pushed into his butt.
His coccyx. He said something about like as he rolls away, it hits him. And then I'm like, okay, man. Yeah. Hey, nothing like no judgment ultimately.
Yeah. But it was interesting how some of this stuff was written. We'll return to that toward the torture scene later.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely some element of like homophobia, but I'm interested in like the fact that like some of it is, I don't know,
homoerotic maybe a little bit.
Yeah. Like maybe there's something there that Ian Fleming had maybe not fully addressed.
Who knows? But I will say reading this book, it occurred to me, it doesn't seem to be aware of how homoerotic it sounds.
Yeah. And I'll just say this. I could see Bond wanting to fuck the American guy more than he wants to like necessarily love this woman. Cause it's all like, it's all about like the sex specifically.
But yeah, you were saying how he gets out of it.
So he gets out of it. Basically, like Luke said earlier, he flails. He flails hard.
He's like, I'm just going to fucking flail and throw my chair backward and hope that I don't die.
He's like one small movement away from getting a trigger pulled and shooting him in the back. Yep. And instead, he's like, I think I can very quickly shove this guy with my, like, shove into the gun. Terrible idea. And absolutely, he should have been shot all over, like, four or five times before he was able to get away from the barrel. But it's just funny because you think of, I think of Bond, this is very capable. Like if you're going to write a very capable spy, badass guy, he's going to do something a little more thoughtful than just flailing. But hey, that's this version that we got.
Well, and then the other like unbelievable thing about this is that the whole premise is that nobody knows this is happening. And after he does it and like lands on the ground, he just like plays it off like he had like a chair malfunction. He's like, oh, this chair. They're like, oh, we'll get you a new chair. Sorry about that. Like, nobody noticed. Like, it's so bizarre. And even the plan to kill him was like, this gun is so silent that I'll shoot you in the spine and then you'll just slump over and everybody, I think you just had like a stroke.
Yeah, but there's people all around. There's people. They're gonna like check out his body to see like where we're at.
So bizarre. But underlining what you're talking about, before all of this, when he's meeting with this other operative, there's a bomb goes off when he's first meeting with Vesper too. This bomb goes off and like blows out the glass in the restaurant they're in. He goes running out. And there's these two guys, and they're like fiddling with these like I think they're like camera cases or something. And he comes up and he like hides behind a tree to like get a look at them, and then they just explode. Because they like accidentally set off a bomb, or maybe there was one case wasn't supposed to have a bomb in it, but there was a bomb in both of them. I don't know. He has some theories about it, but I don't know if it's confirmed. They explode and there's just like, you know, bloody mist everywhere. And he's covered in blood and he gets knocked down, but like he only survives because he's behind this tree and he hadn't like approached them yet, even though he was going to. So like, talking about, again, about like that's the heroic action of Bond, as he comes running up, hides behind a tree, a bomb goes off, and he almost dies but doesn't, and he's just super lucky, and they blew themselves up. Again, that's what his enemies do, so good job, Bond.
Tying this all together, he wrote this, someone told him that he should consider publishing it, and he also had some help in getting it published. Yeah. I'm wondering if as it goes along, like I said, maybe the legacy of Bond is like some of the further novels, he creates and crafts more of a thoughtful and like, you know, really capable Bond.
Not capable, thoughtful. I can almost guarantee. I don't know how thoughtful he gets, but
yeah, I guess not thoughtful in terms of women, but thoughtful in terms of like his
better
plans,
at his job in later plans, books than he is here. Cause he doesn't seem that, I mean, he's good at gambling.
I think Ian Fleming kind of wrote like a pseudo spy story here, but it's just like a guy. It's almost like a Die Hard, like a John McClane, like just like flailing around trying to figure it out. But that's a totally different.
He's definitely not as like superhuman as the Bond that we would later see in the films are. Like he's more of an average guy, although he is like a veteran of World War II, and he has killed people. So by the way, the way that you become a 00 is you have to have killed two people and like in the service of the military or the spy service or whatever. And that's how you become a 00. So he's at least killed two people before. And he talks about it. And it's always like, maybe they were bad. Maybe they weren't. I don't know. I was just there to do a job and I killed them. So again, like, it's not like he's this heroic figure. And I think that's by design for Ian Fleming. Like he wants us to look at this guy as like, maybe he's not very heroic at all. Maybe he's not even a good person. So I'm always trying to remember that as I'm like squaring it with the version of Bond I grew up with, which is very much presented as a heroic figure. Okay, let's get into the next part here, because this is a really interesting section. Desperate to recover the money, Lashif kidnaps Lind and tortures Bond, threatening to kill them both if he does not get the money back. During the torture, a Smersh assassin enters and kills Lashif as punishment for losing the money. The agent does not kill Bond, saying that he has no orders to do so, but he cuts a symbol for the Russian spy-like organization into Bond's hand so that future Smersh agents will be able to identify him as another agent, I guess. This whole section, we already talked about how she gets kidnapped and he's just like pissed off at her. But then he's like, all right, I guess I'll get in my car. And he chases after him in the car and he hits like a spike strip because they planned this. And as good as he is at reading people and predicting things, like he continuously is getting surprised that like other people have plans.
Well, and at this point in the story, he's bested the villain. Like he took all the guy's money.
Yeah, he won all his money. That's right. I don't know if we talked about that, but he wins the second hand and like takes all the money.
Yeah. And he's like, we did it. He's like, we're done. And he's hanging out. He's like,
I'm looking forward to fucking Vesper now that the mission's over.
And you're like, Jesus, dude. So he's like, that's kind of his mindset. And then he keeps getting caught in this scenario where he's like getting comfortable and like allowing himself to relax. And so he's doing that here. And then like she gets taken and he's like, he's not like thinking, oh, this could be a trap in any way.
He just thinks she fucked up. He's like, oh, I can't believe she fucking made some dumb mistake. Like I knew she would.
Yeah, this happens. Yep. So I'm like, okay, you just bested the villain. You don't think he's coming for retribution in any way. Ultimately, we see that this is like a double cross as well. Like she was in on it. The wheels aren't turning there.
So they take him into this like residence to torture him. And he like tries to break free at one point, but can't. He gets sort of like beat up by this dude. Oh, at one point, I think it's this guy. He's like observing back when they're like playing the game. He's talking about how he's kind of like Lenny from Of Mice and Men.
Yeah.
Except for his inhumanity comes from his smoking of marijuana. That was like why this guy was able to be inhuman, is because he smokes the marijuana. So
hell yeah, dude.
Be careful. If you smoke marijuana, you'll become an inhuman killer. So he gets stripped naked and put in this chair where like the seat is cut out of it. And then Lashif has this like weird like carpet beater thing. And he's like just hitting him in the dick and then the balls repeatedly. I guess
which again, like, why specifically that? Like, you can torture him in any way, you know.
Again, he's naked, he's strapped down. This guy's hitting him in the dick, and he's like thinking about how he knows some guys who got tortured in the past, and their advice was like, there's this like bell curve of pain where like it starts out really bad, but then it starts to lessen, and then it becomes kind of like sexual towards the end.
Pleasure.
Become pleasurable. So if you can just get there, you'll be all right. And he's like, all right, I guess I just got to get there. And you can see there's no self-awareness about this. It's like presented totally, and it's like, okay.
Yeah.
They're attacking his manhood, literally. And like his, like the ultimate thing they could do to him is like take away his dick, right? And
emasculation, definitely like the number one thing, like that's his you know kryptonite is like,
it's like worse than death would be the idea of him being left like a eunuch at the end of this. So that's the way the torture plays out, right? Again, all he does is just like lean into this advice he has. He's like, I guess I'll just put it up with it. I'm not going to tell him where the money is because he's like, they're going to kill me either way, so I guess I just won't tell him and I'll just put up with this torture and see how it goes. Maybe it'll start feeling good at the end, I don't know. And then as he's like laying on the ground, like this guy just comes in and shoots him. And it's
shoots
from
the villain.
The villain. Shoots the villain. And then he's like, well, I don't have any orders to kill you. I could, but they're not paying me to do that. So I guess I'll just carve a little symbol into your hand and say, peace out.
Yeah, I guess the symbol means like thief.
Yeah, it's like a mark for other Smersh agents will like recognize something about him when they sees it. I forget the exact meaning of it.
So I just want to mention he's bailed out he's the best gambler, but he loses.
He's
the best spy, but he gets, you know, outsmarted by this trap that they have set for him. They beat him up and then he gets bailed out by the villains of the story, like the other villains of the story.
The other villains, the Russians,
And you're like, okay, so he's kind of just like going, like everything's happening to him at this point. Mm-hmm. Like everything's, he's just kind of there. Maybe pulling some levers here and there, but ultimately the story is going along. I mean, the scene, it brings to mind the film, and I want to say I like Casino Royale. I remember really, really enjoying Casino Royale.
I mean, it's 2006 movie, right? So who knows how I'll feel about it now, but
yeah, I am interested to revisit it. And I do remember the scene's very memorable scene.
Yeah.
And affecting,
it was kind of weirdly sexual in the movie too.
Yeah. But maybe more aware of the fact that it is like that.
Yeah. I mean, we're showing off Daniel Craig, who is a sex symbol, and like maybe a little bit of eye candy for the women watching too, you know?
I'm really interested to see like reconciling the two against each other. Like
I should just say for anyone who is attracted to men watching.
Sure. Yeah. I think that Daniel Craig has an attractive body. You know, how can you not? Like this guy's huge. He's in like the top tier of shape. So like,
I want to see this scene continue a little more.
Right. Yeah. You're like, how long can he take it? And that's part of it too, right?
When will it turn to pleasure, as we've read about in the book?
The toughness, like he's so tough that he can overcome all of this. Yeah, it is interesting to look at this, especially in like the 1950s, is like, this is what masculinity is. And then maybe the legacy of like how that spawns going forward. I'm not saying Ian Fleming is to blame or to credit with the idea of masculinity, but like this, I think Bond is a figure.
Yeah, he's not that powerful, but he plays a role.
Especially in the films, like Bond, I think affected a lot of people and had people like point to and say that's the kind of man I want to be. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see like maybe the birth of that here with Ian Fleming's James
Very
Bond.
Interesting origin. It's not what I was expecting.
Yeah.
You know, like I had heard he was different in the book, but I didn't foresee this version of Bond. So Lind visits Bond every day as he recuperates in the hospital, and he gradually realizes that he loves her. He even contemplates leaving the Secret Service to settle down with her. When he is released from the hospital, they spend time together in a quiet guest house and eventually become lovers. One day, they see a mysterious man named Gettler tracking their movements, which greatly distresses Lind. The following morning, Bond finds that she has committed suicide. She leaves behind a note explaining that she has been working as an unwilling double agent for the Soviet Ministry of Internal Affairs, SMERSH, had kidnapped her lover, a Polish Royal Air Force pilot, who had revealed information about her under torture. SMERSH then used that information to blackmail her into helping them undermine Bond's mission, including her own faked kidnapping. She had tried to start a new life with Bond, but upon seeing Gettler, a SMERSH agent, she realized that she would never be free from her tormentors, and that staying with Bond would only put him in danger. Bond informs his service of Lynn's duplicity, coldly telling his contract, "The bitch is dead now." We get this extended sequence where they go and live together in this like beach house, and Bond is like falling in love with her. He's like, fuck, you know, I do hate her. Like, she's a woman. She's terrible. But, you know, she's kind of hot. And maybe she's not so bad. She's got this secret part of her that makes me think about rape in a weird fucking way. But I guess that makes me like her more now. So he's like, he's going to propose to her to get married.
Yeah. He's considering like kind of leaving the service too.
Leaving the life. Yeah.
I think that this is interesting for a character like this too, but as an origin for Bond, and not that this is his origin, this is just the first story, but as time goes on and we get like Casino Royale in 2006 after all those other Bond films, it is interesting to think of a Bond who is starting to think of like, can I get out? Can I have a real life? Can I have humanity? Like a lot of the
things. And that's the generous read of this, right? And it's clearly here. That's why it comes up really at the end and helped me start kind of recontextualizing the book. It's like at the end, he's being tempted with a life away from this and a life away from violence and inhumanity. And it's represented in Vesper and the feelings he has for her. You know, if you try and get past all the creepy shit, he says about her constantly. it's there. But he also, as brilliant a spy as he is and how, you know, observative he is, he has failed to notice. I mean, he knows something is up. He has not figured out that she's a double agent, even though like it's pretty obvious. he like maybe because she's a woman, he doesn't like see that she could be lying to him and actually a double agent. So caught off guard by this, she commits suicide to protect him, even though she reveals that she had been blackmailed into becoming this double agent. And she also like had a lover who had been kidnapped and tortured, and she was doing all this for him. But because she falls in love with Bond so hard, he's so great, she's like, yeah, I guess he's just gonna get tortured. That's okay. I can live with that now, because now I'm into Bond. So I'm okay with this ultimately. But when it comes out that like they aren't gonna escape them, and she thinks like they're gonna kill Bond, well, I can't stand for that. I would rather die myself than have that happen.
Yeah.
So she commits suicide in this act to save him. And Bond reads this note, finding it out, and like all of the like love and like feelings he had for her immediately get crushed, and he feels them all like going away. And he's like, maybe I'll think about him again one day. They're all gone now. And I was thinking about not, because he has this whole like moral dilemma where he's like, the stuff we do is all just like pointless. It's all just a bunch of people who think they're the good guy fighting and killing each other, and it doesn't really make a difference. That's probably why I'm going to leave. So he has some interesting thoughts about that. But then when this all plays out, he's like, actually, you know what? I'm going to go fucking kill more bad dudes who make shit like this happen. And he's like going even harder into the life at the end.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, he ends by calling her a bitch.
Again, he's grappling with that idea of like good versus evil. Like who's to say I don't think this book is going that deep, but like who is the person who is in charge of all of this? Like who's making that call? And like, you know, it's just different nations vying for power. And then he realizes that she's a spy.
Yeah.
And all, like you said, all those feelings go away. And instead of realizing like the sacrifice that she made was to protect me, he's then like, you know what? She couldn't honor her patriotism or her deal that she made. And that is like even more of a deal breaker than like the fact that he like double crossed her. I think it's even more so like that messaging of like, you didn't stick to the code. You didn't listen to the country. You betrayed your country. Like that's the worst thing you can do. And that's kind of what I'm walking away with is like, it's a story that ultimately comes back to like the power dynamic of like, you serve the country, do sacrifice yourself for the country. And he like sees her as like way beneath him. Cause he's like, I would do all this heinous shit that he'll do, but he's like, I would never give up on my code. And that's like the big sticking point.
Well, think about how this just comes back and underscores everything he's been saying throughout, in a sense, right? Like, even though, like, yes, you can understand why she did the thing she did, ultimately, it's this prophecy that he's had from the very beginning where he's like, she's going to be the fault in my armor. She's going to get me in trouble. She's going to complicate things. And I shouldn't trust her. I don't want her here. And all that, like, basically plays out to be true, in a sense, right? So it underscores his worldview. And we know now that he's going to go forward like probably worse than he was before because this has been so confirmed for him.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It doesn't make me interested in reading more Bond novels. I can tell you that if it's like this, but worse. Oof.
So he does an interesting thing that I think he attempts to do here is tell that story of like the tragic figure that can't be happy also, right? Like Bond, he wants all of these things, but he just can't. The life is going to keep pulling him back in and he's the only one who can do it. So he's got to do it for his country. He's got to do it for all those reasons. I think the book is starting to lean into that. Maybe like further books really go down that rabbit hole.
If you view him as a tragic figure, I think that's the way to enjoy these books. It's like this guy is so flawed and broken and incapable of human connection. And that these books are like his struggles with that and his like desperate attempts to find some flicker of humanity, even as he's like killing people. But then also like, you know, he's a badass. He's that like quintessential guy who's like completely disconnected from his feelings and is only now sort of a machine. I think even at one point they refer to him as a machine. And he's leaning into that and embracing it and saying, that's what I'm going to be. And so maybe that's interesting to read about in the sense of like seeing how he like deals with that going forward. I'm not particularly interested in reading about that, but, it's the podcast. I might, especially if it gets voted for again,
sure,
return to it. But, this isn't a book I particularly enjoyed. I had a lot of rough patches with it, even as I kind of recognize what some people might like about it. It just feels like a conservative, like wet dream in a sense. And I don't like that element of it. Although I will say, like, if you're reading between the lines about like Ian Fleming as this like war veteran who is writing about his PTSD in a way maybe he doesn't even fully understand, you can find some stuff to be interested in here. I'll grant you that.
Yeah, I think there are much better versions of this style of story that do cut down to, of course, but that cut down to like some of the really interesting nuances that come with that. Like, of course, this kind of stuff happens in our world. And what can we like sort of glean from that? And like, what does that do to people? And then doing that like in the tightrope act of also having like someone who you can have characters that are completely flawed as well. Like, you know, you can have a character that's like this, but what's the reason? Cause it seems like the reason here is that it's cool to be a dick to women. And like, that's just not something that I feel like I engage with as a reader.
And so I feel like I gotta like point out too, like I wanted to like say some of the actual lines in the way that he refers to women here, because I think it's like important for the listener to know, they haven't read it, that that's like legitimately what he says in his own mind. Like, that's how he refers to them. He uses those words because I think, like me, people will be shocked. I didn't think he would be that out and out of a misogynist. I thought it would be more about like his actions are kind of, you know what I mean? Like, they're dated and they have misogynistic undertones, and like maybe like the way that he talks and treats to women is dismissive. I didn't expect these like out and out diatribes and using those kind of words about the woman that he supposedly is in love with. Like, it was shocking in a sense. And I the version of Bond I think of is too like high class and like refined to be using words like that. You know what I mean? Like, he would never, like, I don't know. Like, he even if he does kind of objectify women, and of course I'm basing this off of the films I've seen. I don't know about like maybe the older films are much worse about this. He still has like a respect for them and he treats them well. And like, he doesn't even do that here. This version of Bond doesn't do that.
Well, and let's address the fact that, like, I think women watching the Bond films can still, a certain type of woman can or man can totally be attracted to this guy and how capable he is and confident and all those other things.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone is reading this story and saying, like, I'd love to be this person's romantic partner. That's just not the case for this character in this book.
I mean, there are all kinds of people out there. Who knows? But, I think it is what the thing I'm really taking away from that, I think it's a good distinction, is like, this is a separate character and should be thought of separately than the version that we get in the movies.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about a version of Bond next that is very, very different. And I'm going to try not to bring the baggage I have now, because if anything, like, this actually could be detrimental to my view of the character, because I might bring in some of this baggage. I might have to be careful not to do that, because I do think the version in that film too, which is like so far along the like legacy of adaptations about Bond, this is a very different version of this character. And it wouldn't really be fair for me to bring that baggage into this, because it's not trying that.
I am going to come in with an inquisitive eye, though, right? Like, I'm looking for this stuff. I want to see how much of this gets adapted over.
I know there's a lot of scenes that are pretty, like, I mean, they're different, but like, there's a lot of scenes that are clearly inspired from the book, right? Like the
Absolutely.
Gambling scenes, like the torture scene. There's a lot of this stuff that's actually pretty similar. And even like this long romance with Vesper, I think, if I remember correctly, it does happen in the movie. So there's a lot there that is like a kind of directly adapted. I've read elsewhere or heard elsewhere that some of the other Bond novels are like only adaptations in name, and like almost nothing else makes it over from the book. Whereas this one, there actually is some stuff.
Well, I mean, all that being said, I am excited to leave this Bond behind and hopefully enjoy Bond a little more in this adaptation.
I like having the context. I like knowing stuff. I like understanding. And, you know, I now know more about this first book and what this version of Bond originally was, because adaptation is all about change. And what a change this character has undergone over the years, you know?
And continues to change,
and continues to. I'm going to be really curious to see where this character goes, because this is night and day, this version of Bond. You know, maybe there's a couple of things that hold true for the character throughout, and it's interesting to think about what the core like values and like characteristics are that carry through. But so much else, I think, rightfully changes and needs to change for this character to be interesting going forward. Because otherwise, I think you leave this character in the dustbin of history and don't worry about it too much.
Yeah. I mean, Ian Fleming had there's a premise here that I think a lot of people engage with and were interested in. And maybe people of the time period really liked the way that his look at the world. But going forward, I think a lot of people can engage with this premise in general and think like, oh, this is going to be a fun action espionage film that's going to take me to like locales that are really lavish and like all this, you know, all this wealth that we're going to see and like the car that he drives and all this stuff. Like, there's a way of like packaging that and making something like a more, I guess, a film that has like a finer point to it, or like a story that has a finer point. Yeah. Whereas this, it felt really raw from Ian Fleming, this first novel.
I agree. You know, it's like a lot of the glitz and glamour of Bond, I think, is the appeal of it. And the idea of like participating in all of this excess, but not having it actually be the reason you're there. You're actually there for this other reason. You're a covert operative. And you're charismatic and you can wow people and you can read people and you're capable and you can fight people. Like, that's always going to be kind of fun to watch characters like that. And that's what we're going to get in this film. So join us next if you're curious about that. If you enjoyed this episode, please let us know in the form of a rating and review. And if you're on YouTube, let us know in the comments your thoughts on Bond. How do you feel about Bond? You know, when did you first meet Bond? Was it through the films? Is it through GoldenEye, the video game? I'm curious.
And be sure to connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those adding to film. We're also on Blue Sky, TikTok. We're all over the place.
You can support us on Patreon, and that's also how you could choose our next quarterly project. So we do this every few months. We'll do three more this year. So if you want to be in on the next one, make sure to join our Patreon. We also have bonus episodes that come out every month on there. So all that's left is to go visit with Mads Mikkelsen and Daniel Craig in the Casino Royale from 2006. And see how it holds up. I'm going to be really curious.
Me too. Yeah. I remember it fondly, but it's been quite a while. So let's see how this thing holds up.
I wonder if I'll need to know how Baccarat is played. I think they might have played a different game in the movie, if I remember correctly. Yeah,
probably high stakes poker.
Probably poker, yeah. All right. Until next time.
Keep adapting.